we're gonna dive into the learning. The idea here is to have mostly a chronological trajectory and get to have a sort of fairly familiar kind of overview with the different stages of at least specific aspects of the development of Shabbat. And we're going to start with the Tanakh, the Bible. A part of the idea here is to see, like, how does something emerge and develop in halakha, in Jewish law? How does it emerge from the earliest inceptions, the earliest origins, the kind of, you might even say, hints towards particular practices that are in the Torah and in the Tanakh? When you don't only look at the Torah, but look at other parts of the Bible, actually the picture can already become pretty dynamic and interesting, even before you move to any rabbinic sources. But then we will also move to early rabbinic sources and then the various codes of Jewish law, first Maimonides, and then later to the Shulchan Aruch and some more modern approaches. So that's sort of the trajectory is going to be mostly chronological here, and looking at a fairly substantive chunk in each of these along the way. So today we're going to be focusing on Tanakh, the Bible. On Thursday, we'll jump to the Mishnah, the earliest of our rabbinic sources, and we'll be looking at a full chapter of Mishnah at a time. I'm not fully comprehensive of everything the rabbis have to say, but it gives a good window into how this develops. Okay, so great. So now that we've seen some of the things people love, and I don't know if there's something that anybody put in that was most surprising, let's move to our earliest sources. There's a link to the source sheet that Elisheva will put into the chat, and I'm going to be sharing my screen as we take our first delve into Tanakh. Okay, here we go. So this is, in some ways, I love studying Jewish law, any area of Jewish law. I love starting with the Torah, with the Bible, because it is so both overdetermined and underdetermined, right? I think often when we turn to the Torah, we see how not fleshed out so many of the details of a practice are. But sometimes we also see how there are really interesting details that emerge, especially when we look at some later books of the Bible, that we might not have realized were so core to a particular practice. So we're going to do this exercise to look at actually many, if not all, of the substantive sources about Shabbat that are in the Bible. And our question is, how do these different sources affect our sense of what the practice of Shabbat should look like, what it's supposed to accomplish? And in many ways, starting the Bible, well, it's sort of a bit of a zoom out to get to the different values that seem to be interwoven into what we know of maybe as very detailed and specific practices. We'll see some of the different values. There's certainly a dynamic range of values. I don't know how much they're competing. We can talk about that, whether they're in competition with each other. Some of these sources, I assume, will be somewhat familiar, but some, I think, will be a little bit less familiar. Okay, so here we go. We're going to start in the beginning with Bereishit. Okay, may feel extremely familiar. This is the passage that we say on Friday night Kiddush, and we also just read in the Torah, but we're going to start here. And starting here, I want to sort of put forth the vision of Shabbat that is about a world that is at rest, and in parallel to that, a day dedicated to God. Okay, so we have our vision in Bereishit after the 6 days of creation. Vayichulu ha-shamayim va'aretz v'chol tzeva'am. The entire creation is finished. God finishes God's work and then blesses our seventh day, makes it holy, because that is when God rested from creation. Okay, that's our first introduction to Shabbat that is doubled down in the first version of the Ten Commandments, right? When we have in later in the book of Shemot in Exodus, Zachor et Yom HaShabbat LeKadosho, right? You should remember Shabbat and you should make it holy just as God did. You do your work for 6 days. What's the explanation of Shabbat? in this version of the Ten Commandments, Ki sheshet yamim asa Adonai et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz et hayam ve'et kol asher bahem vayanach bayom hashvi'i. Right? God creates the world for 6 days, and then God rests. Al kein berach Adonai et yom hashvi'i v'kadshehu. Right? Therefore, with this rhythm of work and rest, that is why God blesses this day and makes it holy. Okay, so these I think are more familiar sources, but to look at them sort of from scratch, I would ask you, right, why does this seem to be so important, this narrative that God creates for 6 days, rests for 1 day, that rest is also a source of kiddushah, of holiness and blessing. When you just kind of isolate this strand, any thoughts, questions that you have on this picture, the world at rest and a day dedicated to God? And how does this narrative sort of feed that experience and picture of Shabbat? Any comments, questions on this first picture of Shabbat? What is work? Okay, there we go. So great. So I think, right, one question that emerges in this melacha, or our language of melacha, what counts as work? I was just learning the parsha with my 8.5-year-old Boaz, right? And he says, I don't understand. All God did was talk. Why is it so exhausting? Why does he need to rest after 6 days? Was Boaz's question. So great. And maybe that ties into some of what emerged in the opening chat even, right? Maybe it's a certain break or detachment, not only from the physical act of labor, but also from the kind of emotional entanglement of the week, right? It sort of represents God just stepping back, taking a break, even though that's not necessarily based on physical strain. Okay, right, and we're seeing here this idea, Shabbat, we maybe usually think of Sabbath as a holiday, but what we see here is that Shabbat really means cease, end, or rest, this comment from Peter, right? Just that there needs to be some sort of rhythm of doing and then breaking, and that is part of our cycle. Okay, I think in some ways it's not necessarily intuitive how that automatically leads to bracha, to kiddusha, right? How having this rhythm of work and rest necessarily gets you to a place of bracha and kiddusha, of blessing and holiness, other than, right, the setup here that in our own lives we are mimicking the divine practice, right? Maybe just that setup, that mimicry, is in and of itself introducing some sense of an access to the divine, some sense of an access to kiddusha by this story being set up as, well, God did this rhythm first and then we mimic it. We're going to see later, we're going to get to some Second Temple sources at the end of today that are interpreting the Bible, and we'll see a little more explicitly how this idea of a day at rest and a day dedicated to God and holiness are supposed to interact. Okay, we'll move on to some more sources here, because we do need to cover the entire Tanakh in one day. So I'm going to go back to my share. Feel free to continue putting some questions in the chat as we go along here, and I will turn to it at intervals. But if you have an idea, you're welcome to put it there. Okay, so those are maybe the most familiar sources on God resting as the source of Shabbat. Okay, then I brought this fairly lengthy source. You can read through the whole thing on your own after our session. And this is the most extensive discussion of Shabbat in many ways. And this is the story of manna falling. Even before B'nai Yisrael, the Israelites, get the Torah, before they get the Ten Commandments and that specific instruction about Shabbat, they have Shabbat just kind of as an embedded experience of their lives in the Midbar, their lives in the desert, in how they gather manna, how they get the man. Okay, so we're going to look at this. This is the discussion of man. So we have here in Pasuk Kav Gimel, verse 23 in the bold, when we have all the instructions about the man, Vayomer Alehem, Hu asher diber Adonai Shabbaton Shabbat Kodesh Ladonai Machar Et asher tofu efu Bet asher tivashlu bashelu Vekol haodef hanichu lachem lemishmeret ad haboker. So the idea of Shabbat Moshe now gives to the people, he says, right, when they are surprised that they have twice as much man than they have been collecting otherwise, right, he says, this is actually because it's Shabbat. You should prepare whatever you need to prepare, and then, right, you will have it left over for tomorrow, for Shabbat. This is the one exception to the rule where usually the manna goes rotten overnight. Here, it will be good. And you see here, right, I'm bringing this also because this is the introduction to Shabbat that the people get, is that you have to cook in advance for Shabbat. I think we often think of that as, okay, that's some sort of kind of secondary thing. Since you can't cook on Shabbat, you have to end up cooking in advance. What we see here is that actually the primary, the first association with Shabbat that the people have is that you need to prepare everything that you need in advance. And that's going to be really critical as we continue seeing later sources, right? This idea of min hamuchan, everything should be prepared in advance. You walk into Shabbat and everything is ready for you. It's all laid out for you. You don't have to do any work to prepare for that day. You've done all the preparation beforehand. And that is actually a really primary experience of Shabbat, all that preparation that goes in. Okay, so that's one thing we want to draw from the story of the manna, the idea that you prepare in advance. By implication, it sounds like you don't cook on Shabbat, but that's not given here as a don't do. That's not a lav. It's not a kind of negative prohibition mindset. Instead, it's a positive, right? Bake what you will bake the day beforehand. It's the positive preparation. Okay, right. Similarly, besides the not cooking on Shabbat that's sort of implied here, we see in verse 26, Pasuk Kav Vav in the bold, Sheshit imim tilketuhu vayom hashivi'i Shabbat lo yebo. For 6 days you gather, and on the seventh day you don't gather. It's a Shabbat. It ceases. And here also, right, the work that the Israelites had to do in the Midbar, it seems like maybe, certainly before they're preparing to build the Mishkan, maybe the only work that they did, maybe their only melacha was really that act of gathering manna, right? That's what they have to do day in, day out. They have to go and collect their food. And that's kind of symbolic of all the work that we do. It was just very, very simplified for them. It was the act of gathering was their whole work. And so that's what they do all week, and then they stop. I want to share, I don't know if everyone might have their kind of quintessential Shabbat story, or maybe a few quintessential Shabbat stories. One of my quintessential Shabbat stories that made me think of this verse was when I did a cross-country trip. I had 1 week to get from Buffalo, New York to Los Angeles, because there was a class that my fiancé had to be teaching on Sunday, so we had to make sure that we got to Los Angeles in time to teach that class. So we had 1 week to drive. So we drove basically the entirety of the day, every day, and then pulled into Zion National Park just before the sun was setting. The rays of sun were already kind of getting a little bit redder as we were pulling into the canyon, and then we didn't drive for 1 day. And I remember feeling like, oh, this is really what Shabbat should feel like. It's you do the same thing day in, day out, all day, and then you have 1 day that is just so obviously a break from that. And it made me think of this verse. For 6 days you gather, and then that 1 day you just stop. Okay, so that is sort of the idea of not cooking, the idea of not gathering. But I want to go to the last verse here, which I think might sound a little bit strange to us when we think of how primary it is in the Torah, as part of Shabbat, that we'll see in the end of our session today how this gets developed in Second Temple sources, right, in the end of verse 29 here, Pasuk Kaftet, our next bolded section, right, part of this idea that you don't have to leave to gather food in the field, you don't have to leave to gather manna, is Shivu Ish Tachtav. Everybody should just stay in their own place. Al Yetze Ish Mi Mekomo Bayom HaShivi'i. Nobody should leave their place on the seventh day. And this is one moment where if you forget, if you let yourself kind of actively forget everything you know about what Shabbat looks like, especially, I don't know, going to shul, for example, going to other people's houses for meals, for example, if you let yourself kind of peel that away from what you think Shabbat is, and encounter these words in the Torah on their own. This is why I love starting any study of halacha, of Jewish law, in the Torah and in the Bible itself. If you actually take these words at face value, it sounds like on Shabbat, you are maybe in some sort of lockdown, to use words that maybe have too much of a resonance these days. It's not just that you're not doing your work. It's not just that you've prepared things in advance. It's not just that you don't have to go out to the field to do work. It's that this is actually a day to stay right where you are, right? You just stay at home and not have any reason to cross the threshold. And that is sort of one of the most extreme versions of a picture of the world at rest. It's not just that you're not doing work, but you don't see that language, lo ta'asu melacha. You don't see that here. You do see don't gather, but you see it all framed as really the most extreme kind of resting. You just stay in place. Okay, any thoughts, comments on this picture of Shabbat? Right, we've sketched out, I think, some of the language we're more used to about taking a break from your work, and now gone to maybe what's a more extreme picture here of staying in place on Shabbat. Any reactions to what this view of Shabbat kind of means? If you can imagine a Shabbat where you literally just stay inside, which may be more imaginable in the past 9 months than it had been previously, any thoughts or comments on what Shabbat seems to be accomplishing in this picture?
Why did we talk about the gathering? Why not stopping working?
Right, so why does the verse specifically single out gathering? Right, so I think, so in some ways, it could very likely be that that's meant to be indicative of any kind of work, but in the desert, when they're getting all of their needs tended to, it seems like that actually is the main form of work that they have to do. So it's sort of a tailored version of don't do melacha, don't do work. For them in the desert, what that means is don't gather. What becomes very interesting about this is the idea of a quintessential experience of Shabbat as not relating to stuff, not gathering stuff. We'll see how prominent that is in the Mishnah, in early rabbinic sources. That didn't emerge really in our opening chat, right? People had a lot to say about lighting candles, about prayer, resting from technology. The idea of not gathering stuff as core to Shabbat might not be the way we think about it so much, but that does seem to be very central in this picture, in the Torah. And in some ways, right, you could describe that as like, okay, that's circumstantial. That's because that's the work that they were doing in the desert. Right? But it could also be that part of the vision here is Shabbat is supposed to transform and maybe kind of shake us up in how we are relating to materiality, material objects, right? If actually most of the week is dedicated to our relationships with stuff and even ownership of stuff and kind of manipulating the physical world around us, taking a break from that relationship to gathering stuff could actually be very core. Okay, I'm just looking at this chat here about not thinking about the work. Okay, this is coming from Steve in the chat. This is a great, great thing. We're going to see this. We'll get a taste of this in today's sources, the mental piece, the mental detachment from work. We're going to see this even more on Thursday when we look at some of the rabbinic sources. Pressing Shabbat mode on your mind. I like that. How do you get your mind into Shabbat mode if we sort of think about that? These days, some refrigerators have Shabbat mode. How do you get your mind into Shabbat mode? Can actually take quite a lot of work. Okay, and we're seeing a question here from Gil. Right? How do we do this? How do we stop feeling acquisitive if actually we're kind of hardwired day in, day out to be in acquisition mode, to think of how do we get the stuff that we need? It's very much, from an evolutionary perspective, something that we are kind of wired to be focused on. How do we get the stuff we need to have enough to eat, to have clothing, whatever? How do we stop that? That's a right great question. And we'll see if some of the sources that we look at give us any tools to make that shift. Okay, and then, right, so and I want to relate to this question that David posted, right, is staying in place at the end of that chapter in Exodus about the man, the manna, is it only related to not going out to gather manna, or is it broader than that? So that's an interpretive question. I would say certainly the way that we are inclined to practice Shabbat that doesn't require lockdown, generally, would assume that when you get to that verse in the Torah, it means to just double down on don't gather manna, right? Don't go out of your door to gather manna. But I think if you look at that with fresh eyes, and as we'll see, there's sort of some Second Temple sources that go this way, it actually seems like not gathering manna is just one of the things that you're not doing outside, but that's kind of building up to a much more extreme experience of actually the kind of climax of this description of Shabbat is almost like your body stops in place. You don't leave where you are. You just stop in a much more fundamental way. And in as much as that might sound kind of claustrophobic to think of, I think it's also an extremely powerful idea. I'll say as an aside, this is tangential, when Maimonides makes a code of Jewish law, we'll look at some of it on Shabbat later, we're not going to look at this, but when Maimonides describes the laws of Yom Kippur, it's always interesting to see what titles Maimonides uses for different sections of Jewish law in his code. In his code of law, the Mishneh Torah, the description of Yom Kippur is Shvitat Asur, the rest of the seventh day. It's the rest. It's described as the most extreme rest. And Maimonides describes all sorts of things like not eating and drinking. Maimonides doesn't actually describe primarily as afflicting yourself. Maimonides primarily describes that as an even more complete rest than Shabbat, than our usual Shabbat. So I bring that to you because when you think about, well, what does this word mean to rest? And we're used to immediately translating that as don't do work. What we see here is there could be more extreme versions of rest that are literally just trying to stay in place and actually rest as much as possible. And we'll see this idea that like maybe that also means don't put food into your body, right? That's actually kind of doing work and being active to put food into your body, right? We'll see how that emerges in some of these Second Temple sources as the most extreme picture of Shabbat. I love doing this, kind of exploring what's the most expansive read of these early sources that we can uncover and discover, some of which might be very repelling, some of which might be very compelling, but some of which might be repelling. I think it's always good to kind of build that biggest dynamic range so that we can sort of locate ourselves and our practice within that. Okay, Meryl, did you have a question? Just make sure you unmute.
Yeah, I was just going to make a comment, I guess, as I'm thinking about it, is that the mana gathering that they have to do really is their work, because they don't have actual jobs or other things that they're doing at that point. And so all the work that we do, our jobs, everything that we do is leading us to our sort of mana gathering. I mean, we work to make money to buy our food. So it's similar, that similar idea that we just don't do any of that on Shabbat. And then the idea that even if you wouldn't leave your own home, which I don't know how many people would have lived in one tent or whatever together, but that you're together just with that nuclear family, that you can, and even today, that's how I feel, I guess, is by knowing that for that 25 hours that you can't do any work, that you can sort of, you do sort of say in your mind a little bit like, there's nothing I can do about this. It's going to have to wait till Sunday or Monday. So I'm just going to let it go. And that those hours really can be very relaxing. I mean, that really can be, if you let that stuff go and you just stay in the moment with the people that you're with, is very, can be really relaxing. And you wake up the next day feeling sort of like you're starting over.
Great. Okay. Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah. And in some ways, I think what you're drawing out is that relationship between stopping the work, right? That prohibition, don't do melacha. What is that trying to accomplish? What can that enable? Right? And what we're seeing here is, in some ways, that enables you to be fully present where you are and with the people who you're maybe nearby somewhat frequently, or maybe not nearby if you have to go farther afield to do your work. And you can actually have some bandwidth to focus on what is more immediately present. Okay, thank you. But yes, I love this idea, right? What's your version of don't gather manna on Shabbat, right? The idea that that's a paradigm. We'll see, I don't know if we're going to see this super explicitly, we might, but it just foreshadow it. There's one reading in early rabbinic sources that maybe the prohibition on work wasn't blanket prohibitions that everyone couldn't do all work. It might have been, you don't do your profession on Shabbat, right? We'll see that emerges as one source. Okay, yes, Sandra, last comment on this, and then we're going to move on. Go ahead.
What immediately came to mind when you mentioned the word stuff was and this is a really modern modern day interpretation of this, is you don't go shopping.
Mm-hmm.
Which is an activity.
Amazing.
That either it's a burden or it's a pleasure for some people during the other 6 days.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. So you're actually foreshadowing Nehemiah that we're going to see later, but the idea that not gathering stuff, as opposed to just not doing work, could be very core to Shabbat, and that might look like not going shopping these days. Yes. We'll see more of that, as we go on. Okay. I'm gonna move us on in our approach here to various sources in Tanakh. Okay, this is probably, it's maybe a little bit too cute of a title here, but Shabbat and Social Justice. But I want to look now at the second version of the Ten Commandments, where very famously there it's introduced not by Zachor, but by Shamor. Shamor et Yom HaShabbat L'Kadosho. Keep Shabbat. So here we have that distinction that we'll see the rabbis make between Zachor, the positive aspect, Shamor, the negative aspect. But if you go on in this, the whole explanatory frame for Shabbat is actually different than Bereishit, and I think often totally doesn't get its full due. Here we have, what's the point of Shabbat here? You take a rest on Shabbat. Lo ta'aseh chol melacha, I'm reading in the middle of 13. Don't do any work. Ata, bincha, bitecha, avdecha va'amatecha shorcha chamorcha v'chol behemtecha v'gercha asher bisharecha. It's not just that you're not doing work, it's you assumed here to be you, the owner of an estate. Your whole family doesn't do work. The people who work for you don't do work, right? Your slaves, servants, and your animals don't do work. And the stranger who maybe is also somebody who you might be employing on sort of day-to-day for day labor because they don't have their own land, right? None of you do work. Why? What's the whole point of this? L'ma'an yanuach avdecha v'amatcha kamocha, so that your servants can rest like you. Okay? The actual point of this is for your servants to be resting like you. And the whole frame here is not bringing us back to Bereshit, the creation of the world, but bringing us to leaving Egypt. V'zacharta ki eved hayita be'eretz Mitzrayim. You have to remember that you were slaves and God took you out. And so, in many ways, Shabbat seems to be, if not an actual Yitziat Mitzrayim for your servants, it's not an actual end to their slavery, it is a break from Shabbat, right? And it actually seems here that the reason you have to stop doing work on Shabbat is so that you will not be managing all the other people who you end up having work for you when you're on the mindset of getting work done. If you have a day where there's no work you're trying to get done, then also the people who work for you will have a day where they're not getting work done. And the point of this is for them to have a break. Okay, in case you thought this was somewhat subtle, right, we see in later parts of Tanakh that Shabbat is associated with justice. So I brought you a little passage here from the book of Amos, sort of derailing against people who are swallowing up the needy, shoafim evyon, making the poor fail, right? These people are saying, Matai avor hachodesh v'nashbira shever v'hashabbat v'niftecha bar lahaktin efa lahagdil shekel ula'avet moznei mirma. Right? They're waiting for the new month, which was a festival then, to be over, waiting for Shabbat to be over so that they can go back to market in order to exploit people. Right? It's very clear here that there's a sort of association between their desire to be in the marketplace and they have, right, they're dealing unfairly with coinage here, right? They have false balances. The gnot ba kesef dalim ba'avion ba'avor na'alayim, right? To buy the poor for silver, the needy for a pair of shoes, right? It's, the rhetoric is obviously quite strong here, but you have an association here between melacha, right? That doing work is taking advantage of those who are destitute. Shabbat is meant to be a break from that. So Shabbat is sort of one glimmer of what a more just world could look like. And we have this sort of double down in Isaiah, right? A person who is just, who is righteous, is also somebody who keeps Shabbat. Shomer Shabbat mechalalo, the Shomer yado me'asot ra, in the end of verse 2 here. Keeping Shabbat is synonymous with not engaging in evil, and we have the maybe more famous passage from Isaiah, from the Haftorah for Yom Kippur, that associates taking care of the needy and keeping Shabbat. Okay, so this isn't only kind of a modern spin on what Shabbat could be, that it's meant to be a day that brings us to social justice. This is there in the sources. It's actually kind of as front and center as the creation of the world, this idea of Shabbat as a way to treat those who are more vulnerable in society in a just way. Okay, and here's this passage from Nehemiah that I'm put here because it discusses trading and selling. It might not be fair for it to be right here in this same column about social justice, but based on that passage from Amos, where engaging in selling is associated with exploitative practices of in the marketplace. Right here we have sort of a quintessential restriction on Shabbat is not loading up items onto donkeys and taking those items to go and sell them, right? This gets to the comment of, oh, maybe Shabbat in its essence is about not going shopping if we go back to not collecting manna. We see this here, that the sort of frame of Shabbat is about not buying and selling. And I think that's important to put right here because you don't necessarily think of this as tied to one of the 39 melachot, the 39 forms of labor that are more known about for Shabbat. Sometimes it's tied to carrying, but we see here that the not taking a break from buying and selling is actually core on Shabbat. And what I'm trying to say here is that might be because that practice of amassing stuff will probably inevitably have some level of exploitative practices behind it. Okay, so we're running out of time, so I just want to look at these last two pieces before we close up today. There's another vision of Shabbat. We saw a world at rest, day dedicated to God, some kind of reminder, mindset of justice. Jewish identity is something that emerges as well in the Torah. Right here, we have the Kiddush that we say Shabbat day. And at the end of this passage, V'shemru b'nei Yisrael ta Shabbat, Israel should keep the Sabbath. It's a sign of a brit. Beni uvein b'nei Yisrael oti li'olam. It's a sign between me and the Jewish people. So you can sort of see this in isolation as Shabbat, as a sort of distinctive aspect of Jewish identity. Often I think when we're in the world, we feel that way. I often feel like, oh, Shabbat is the day where if I'm walking through the world, I feel more different than other people around me. But I think one of the questions that I really want to put forth in looking at these three different approaches to Shabbat is, are they meant to be intertwined? But you could see them as somewhat competing, going in their own directions. But you could see this idea of Shabbat and Jewish identity as something that's supposed to serve the kind of substance of our brit, of our covenant with God, that is embedded in doing mishpat, right, doing justice. And maybe when we're resting, having a day dedicated to God, it's supposed to recenter us in the values that we care about, and again, would tie into Shabbat as a day of justice as well. Okay, gonna spend just a second here on some of these Second Temple sources. When we look at the earliest sources in the Bible, it's always also fun to see the Second Temple sources, because sometimes they draw out readings of the Bible that are different than the rabbinic readings. So this is from the Book of Jubilees, an early writing that is part of the Apocrypha and Christian Bible. We see here a discussion of various things not to do on Shabbat. That includes not preparing food, right? Again, going back to the story of the manna, right? Not taking things through the gates, right? Which may also be the don't leave your place. And not taking things from house to house on that day. So again, there's sort of quite an emphasis on manipulating and moving stuff. We also see here some further restrictions, right? Whoever lies with their wife, right? The act of sexual relations is considered anathema to Shabbat here. But that's not the way the rabbis go. There's a sort of actually idea to engage in pleasure and in sexuality on Shabbat as well. So that's one point of divergence that is worth drawing. But also we see here a restriction on fasting, which implies that there are some people who are fasting on Shabbat. So here, right, I think there's some, when we say Shabbat, what does it mean to fully rest? There's a line being drawn here that Shabbat isn't about refraining from eating and drinking, which seems like some people are interpreting that way. But it is about refraining from sexuality. For the rabbis, Shabbat is going to actually actively include engaging in eating and drinking and even sexuality. Okay, so that's just one piece to draw here. And finally, right, this little bit from Josephus, when he describes Shabbat and taking a break from work, says explicitly that is so that the Jews can spread out their hands in their holy places and pray till the evening. Okay, so we haven't actually seen this before, but in our experience, it's very prominent. You take a break from other things so that there's time to pray, right? So that day of rest and day dedicated to God are really parallel here, a day to learn our customs and our laws, where you see the more active engagement of what it means to dedicate this day to God. And the last piece that I want to look at is So we have also in these other sources from the Second Temple, right, some discussion of Jewish distinctiveness that emerges in Shabbat. And we won't get to do this fully inside, but we have in some of these Second Temple sources as well restrictions even on going to the bathroom, restrictions on leaving one's home. There's a more intensive reading of Al Yetzei Ish Mimkomo, right, not leaving our place. And what I want to leave us with is, now we've seen some of these we've seen some extreme pictures of what Shabbat could mean in the Second Temple period, right? Integrating that word to rest, that could mean actually more fully staying at home, really being careful about not touching any objects that aren't absolutely essential for the day. And we see that there's some people who aren't even touching food. They're fasting, even if that's being pushed back against here. Right? How does this emerge into what we know of as Shabbat, where there's obviously still an integration of what the Torah has to say about Shabbat, but alongside some less extreme pictures of what it means to stop and rest, and still enabling this kiddusha and rejuvenation to happen. So we'll stop here on our trek, mostly of biblical sources and some of those more extreme interpretations in the Second Temple.